I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. When was your last trip to see the ocean, to go to the beach? Mine, as it so happens, many months ago with a family. It was winter, actually. We searched for sand dollars, poked around in tidal pools. Most of us were only brave enough to wade out far enough to get our knees wet, because as I said, it was winter and the water was cold. A summer visit, that's a different story altogether. We'd behave differently. But the temperature on this trip was quite the deterrent. We were there to see the views, to be out in the glorious open air, to smell the salt on the breeze, to see the coastal redwoods, Northern California, watching pelicans dive, scanning the horizon for whales, that sort of thing. I definitely was not there to get into the water. But if I had gone to the beach, oh, let's say with an 18th or 19th century frame of mind, even in a place like Northern California, the chilly water might have been precisely the draw, the very thing I was after, and I would have gone to dip myself in, up to my neck or even higher, all for the sake of health, good health. You see, apparently the allure of the beach these days is many things. Sand volleyball, surfing, beachcombing, bird watching, running, snorkeling, camping, barbecuing. But a couple of centuries ago, these things were not the big attraction. They had not even invented the Frisbee yet, maybe not even the beach ball. In fact, I'll confess, I Googled that. 1938, the year for the earliest known inflatable beach ball. Well, today we're going to go back in time and learn what beaches were for previously, what they signified in the past for us humans, how we approached them, what they offered us, or at least what we thought they offered us, and maybe even something of a worldview about beaches that today would strike us as, well, kind of foreign and maybe even bizarre. Historian Robert Ritchie is with us. He is Senior Research Associate at the Huntington Library, and he's author of The Lure of the Beach, A Global History. Roy Ritchie, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, have you been to the beach lately? Got any sand between your toes?
Not lately. It's been a few weeks back.
Well, that's a lot more recently than I went. And what was your aim in going to the beach?
Just the usual thing, to enjoy the water, the air. The whole setting is quite wonderful still to go to the beach. I spend a good deal of my life close to it. I don't live quite as close now, but it's always great fun.
Well, it hasn't been that long ago that I did see some kind of, I think it was a BBC drama, maybe, and it's just kind of those period pieces that the BBC does where it's maybe in the Victorian times or earlier, and you see them at the beach, and for one thing, the attire amuses us, and their hesitance as they approach the water is amusing. I even think I once saw a period piece from the BBC where royalty was, taken down to the waters. Is that kind of where we're headed?
You're referring back to Jane Austen's last novel, she never finished Sanditon, which the BBC did as a full-scale production, and they tried to make it as accurately as possible. And one of the things I wanted to get at in writing the book was, why did people go to the beach? And discovering that when they did it in the 1730s in England, it was for different reasons than you and I have just expressed about our desire to go to the beach. Because for them, there had been a growing literature in the early 18th century of the benefits of cold water. A man called Sir John Floyer published a number of books on that. And toward the end, he also started to say, salt water is wonderful. It's cold, and it has therapeutic value. And so the reason people start going to the beach is really for therapeutic purposes. They go because they think it's part of a cure. And that's where it all begins.
So are we going to talk mostly about Great Britain and the views there, or can we also branch out, talk about maybe a little bit of ancient history or what's happening in say, the Mediterranean region?
There was a resort in Rome, down in the Bay of Naples called Baiae, quite famous in its day, goes on for centuries, actually. And hosts emperors, everybody who's important in Rome ends up at Baiae one time or another, although it has a terrible reputation for decadence. When the Senate stood down in April, they went to Baiae and they let their hair down, and people like Seneca, who was a Stoic, he was quite appalled at the behavior there, and he left after one day. So Baie had a significant reputation, but then during the long Middle Ages in Europe, beach culture really died. They just didn't go there, and part of it is, of course, we'd understand that they would look at the Bible and see that the Great Flood had brought all the detritus into the oceans, and there things had grown out of it, and they're the evil creatures that line the edge of maps. And so it's not something that grows during the medieval era, but suddenly in the 1730s, boom, in England first, it'll go to the continent, come to America in the 1820s, but it's really there in Britain first.
Is it safe, perhaps, to view this as the beach front or the ocean front was seen as, yes, a barrier, and yet for livelihoods, there were fisheries, there were fisher folk, and they yep. were out in their boats. But can we safely draw a line between what one did occupationally and going to the beach just for entertainment?
Yeah, there's a very strict line. I mean, the folks who are out there doing the fishing are ordinary, they're all men, making a living. The people who are going to go to the beach for therapeutic purposes are aristocrats. They're the only people who can afford to get there. First of all, they have the time. Secondly, they have the coach and the horses that would allow them to get to places like Brighton, which is south of London, 56 miles. But in the old days, it took 2 days to get there because the roads are so bad. So, it's a very limited, very aristocratic, upper-class audience that begins going to the beach at the beginning.
So what I've seen in the movies where they're wearing what today is very prim and proper attire at the beach, I mean, that's a world apart. The idea of dressing up to go to the beach, to putting on your duds, that's kind of strange.
This is a big gender separation. If you're talking about aristocratic women, they are not in the habit of displaying their bodies. And so when they go into the water, they're in a sort of a shroud that leads from the neck to their ankles. And in fact, they get into a little wagon and it hauls them into the water. And again, this is therapeutic. You go there to be dipped 3 times. Your head has to be under the water, then back out into the little wagon, the bathing machine, which takes you back up the beach again, and you get out. And in the meanwhile, you've changed clothes in the bathing machine, and you get out fully dressed again. On the other hand, men swim nude. It's just a big gender divide. Men have always gone swimming nude. Not that very many of them went swimming, but they did go swimming nude. And so England has this very peculiar practice then of not having, mixed bathing, but of having gender-segregated bathing with men further down the beach on one end of the beach if it's a long beach and women at the other end of the beach, or men get to swim before 8 o'clock in the morning, the ladies come out at 11 o'clock in the morning. So England is rather peculiar that way. The French and the Americans, for instance, they have mixed bathing right away, and the men do wear, outfits. But in England, it's a long struggle, not till the end of the 19th century, before you really can impose bathing costumes on men and they have to wear them.
So. Now, this notion of the salubrity of the experience of being dipped in the water, the idea that this is going to somehow foster good health, this idea, it was persistent. It stuck around for decades, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, a long time. I mean, at the end of the 19th century, there are books still being published recommending bathing in salt water as a sort of it becomes an almost universal cure to its great advent. A lot of doctors buy into this and go to the beach during the summer with their patients and, get them going in. And, salt water can help some skin conditions, but by and large, it's not a universal Bethesda that will bring about cures. I mean, but people remember this is a world that does not have all the medicines, all the treatments, all the equipment that we have today. You're looking at a very limited pharmacology. And that's one of the reasons, for instance, it's a fairly easy transition to go to the beach if you've gone to Bath or Tunbridge Wells or any of the other great spas in England. And the spas dot Europe, and these are all mineral water springs that people feel by drinking this kind of water, it's therapeutic. And some of them are indeed mildly therapeutic. So that's one culture, and it's easy then to go to the beach and, you know, dip into water there. And some people even drink the salt water in hopes of a cure. But it's also, they will say scientifically, that the sea air is pure, and it opens the lungs, and it's wonderful. And, you know, who's not to argue that, you know, sea air is a wonderful thing? So it's very therapeutically driven, and it will remain that way for quite a while. People go to the beach because they feel there's a benefit to their health in doing so.
Well, it's one thing to be dipping in salt water. It's another thing to add the dimension of the frigid temperatures of water, the idea that cold water could be good for you. I want to talk about that in just a moment some more with you. We're going to take a short break as we're visiting with Roy Ritchie. He's author of The Lure of the Beach, A Global History. Constant Wonder continues in just a moment. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. Robert C. Ritchie is with us. He's author of The Lure of the Beach, A Global History. Roy Ritchie, we were talking about salt water being believed at one time to be particularly conducive to good health. But what about the temperature? The idea that taking, you know, I see kind of a bit of a parallel here going on to what happens in modern times. We see on the news every year something about the polar bear plunge, or maybe somewhere in Siberia people are cutting through the ice to take dips into the water. And this is a persistent idea that miserable experience is going to be good for you.
Yep. No, it's a long-standing idea that cold water is good for you. I mean, John Locke recommends it, for instance, for children, dipping children in cold water. But you also have to remember, this is the Little Ice Age. And that, you know, the water temperatures are not that warm around England to begin with, and with the Little Ice Age there, they're a few degrees lower. So this is brisk, and everybody, you know, I've read a lot of diaries and journals of 18th century people, and the first time they go into the water, boy oh boy oh, they remember it. I mean, they put it in their diaries, it was frightful, it was terrible, but it's good for my health, so I'm just going to keep doing it. I have to keep doing it. But they continue to moan and groan about how cold the water is.
Well, you had made reference earlier to the fact that this was an activity for the aristocracy coming, you know, the blue blood or the highbrows. And yet there does come a time when there's a little bit more democratization of access to the beaches and participation. And I guess there's some social tension over this, too.
Yep. Well, it comes with the railway. The steam engines arrive in the early 19th century, and by the 1840s, the system has gotten big enough that the railway men are willing to build lines down to, well, particularly places like Brighton, Margate, Scarborough, the Blackpool, the big resorts in England. And so that then makes it possible for other people. And right away would be the upper professional classes, wealthy merchants. They would still be quite well-to-do, but now they're able to go in a first-class carriage to the beach. Well, once you've got the train tracks in and the trains are sitting there, why not on a Sunday take excursion trains down to the beach? And that then opens the way for the middle class and even the upper working class to go. They can only go on excursions because these folks just don't have paid time off, not until the very end of the 19th into the 20th century. So, yes, it begins to broaden out, and along with that, a lot of things have to change, particularly entertainment, because in the beginning, this is all, as I mentioned earlier, Jane Austen. This is very much Jane Austen's world of assembly rooms, of dining in assembly rooms, dancing, lectures, entertainment, you name it, it all goes on in the assembly rooms. Well, that's not where these people go. They don't entertain themselves there. And so then what you have coming, and the beach resorts are always very resilient. They absorb all of this as they go. That, you know, more and more people expect to get their entertainment in the music hall. or in the dance hall. These are places where they like to go, and so they have to adapt, and, you know, these audiences get bigger and broader. Middle-class people can come for a week. Okay, they'll be in boarding rooms. One of the big developments of the 19th century is the invention of the hotel, and then the hotel taking over all of the purposes of the assembly room. That's where you'll go to dance. That's where you'll go to have meetings, you know, besides the dance halls and the music halls. These are all part of a, you know, middle 19th century Victorian culture that is really more identified with the middle class than it is with the upper class. The upper classes are still there, but the numbers, because the railways are growing and growing, the resorts are getting bigger and bigger. And by the end of the 19th century, you know, Blackpool, a big popular resort, is getting, you know, a few million people a year coming. It's quite a large place.
So you're talking about the era then in which just the appetites of the masses shape the culture of the beachfront.
Yep, yep. No, it's again, if you bring more and more people in, you bring their life and lifestyle with them. And that means that these are folks who at home on a Saturday night or a Friday night or even during the week would go to be entertained at a music hall, hear singers, comedians, see all kinds of performers, dancers, you name it, they all appear in the music halls. And, of course, once the resorts take in music halls and whatnot, that's great for the performance. It extends their season because normally they work through, you know, the fall, the winter, and spring. Then, you know, everything vanishes for them. Well, now they've got the music halls at the beach, and so, boy, they love it. And so you get the same kind of entertainers that you would have through the rest of the year coming to the beach resorts and facing new audiences.
So this whole evolution historically of how the beach was a place for the aristocracy to begin with, and that morphed and became a resort destination for the middle classes and the working classes, across the Atlantic in a place like New York, was there anything similar to that in the evolution, or did you just start with Coney Island, you know, hot dogs, cotton candy, and roller coaster?
Coney Island comes along late. I mean, Cape May, Nahant, various places, Atlantic City, all precede Coney Island. Coney Island is a great beach, but what makes Coney Island fabulously well-known is electricity, because that allows them then to power up new rides of roller coasters, Ferris wheels, you name it, all kinds of rides, bumper cars. And that then is a new form of entertainment takes over, and at the height of its glory in the 1890s, the first couple of decades of the 20th century, Coney Island has three amusement parks that are brilliantly lit at night, so they're extending daytime into night. They also have music halls, entertainment. They'll do all kinds of fabulous things, quite extraordinary, making Coney Island, you know, incredibly famous. People want to go there. And again, at night, it's brilliantly lit with electrical bulbs, and we, commonplace for us. But for most people, even in suburban America, rural America, that is even less so, but there might be a light bulb at the corner of Main Street. But it wouldn't, you know, be street lighting the way we have it now. So that you go to this place, and my Lord, it's just a brilliant, ablaze with light. And so Coney Island leads the way into a very new form of entertainment that will be picked up by Blackpool. In fact, Blackpool now has the most successful amusement park in all of Western Europe. It's been going on for well over a century now. So, you know, these are, you know, big innovations that come with another technology, in this case, electricity, a power source.
I kind of think that in the United States, and I'm no historian here, so I'm just kind of, you know, shooting from the hip, but I kind of think that we went through this time period in the mid-20th century when the beaches were primarily places of amusement, but that maybe there were still some vestiges in pockets here and there, the idea that the beach was a healthy place to be. And certainly by the latter part of the 20th century, the beach had its kind of that whole aura of good health and well-being associated with the beach. You know, Southern California beaches. Is there a genealogy that you can trace clear back to a place like Brighton in the 1730s?
I mean, these, again, beach resorts are really quite remarkable institutions in the sense that they start out being aristocratic, and the forms of entertainment are there. Then they absorb more and more people. They absorb more and more types of entertainment. They're always trying to be leaders when it comes to things like entertainment, because in these days, if you're going into the water for therapeutic reasons, it's all over in an hour. And so then you're back on the, you know, the shore again, and you've got to live life. And so entertainment is a big thing. And it's not really until you get into the 20th century with the evolution of the sun becoming heliotherapeutic that the sun now enters the picture as being something that's also very good for you. We have a somewhat different view, but starting out early on, sunbathing was regarded as very good for your health. And people really get into it. And one of the results of that, of course, is that women's bathing suits have to change quite dramatically from not showing much flesh to showing more flesh. But that happens over about 40 years, that women slowly but surely get toward what we would consider a modern bathing suit. But it's done in part in order to take advantage of this new therapeutic regime, the sunbathing. And so, you know, people then begin, rather than sort of getting in the water, coming out, spending more time at the beach, actually putting up an umbrella, putting down a blanket, sitting out, you know, exposing yourself now and then, coming back in. It's, you know, again, it really changes the nature of people's relationship to the beach. It's not a thing you go over in order to get into the water, come out again. It's a place you spend time. And if you're spending more time there, you're also going to spend more time in the water. And so the resorts will have to put up big poles with ropes because, again, people are doing this on their own now. And they will be out there jumping up and down in the waves. And one result of that is the 1890s, the lifeguard is invented because people are drowning because of, you know, making a misjudgment in the water.
Well, now that we have kind of seen the arc of history going clear back to those days of Brighton and up to the present time, what do you see as developments going forward where civilization abuts the ocean?
You know, the fact is more and more of us live close to the water. It's over 50% of the American population now lives in a county that abuts an ocean, whether it's the Atlantic, the Gulf, or the Pacific. So there's more and more of us closer to the water, and there's more and more of us want access to the water as a result. And access is a big issue because pretty much every state guarantees the right of you're able to get access to a public beach up to the mean high tide line. And the problem grows, of course, between the mean high tide line and where grass starts to grow and, you know, land takes over. And getting access to the area below the mean high tide line has come to be a contested area. States like Connecticut, here in Southern California with Malibu, if there are more and more people want to live closer and closer to the beach, it means house prices are ever more expensive. If you spend $20 million on a mansion in Malibu and you open the door in the morning and you've got a bunch of people lazing around down your beach, putting up their beach umbrellas, are you going to like that? No. And so Malibu has fought a long battle, as have various townships in Connecticut, to keep people away from the beach. So the folks who should be there can be there, but only you, your family, and your friends you want to have in the beach in front of you, whether it's Malibu or the Hamptons. And so as there's more and more pressure on beach-related property, states like Texas, which has had a very good open beach policy, Alabama, Florida, are now beginning to give more rights to property owners adjacent to the beach in order to help them preserve their views and their privacy. So that's one area that is of growing concern as more and more of us pack toward the coast.
Yeah, well, it's of concern primarily to the elite, so we're back to the aristocracy, yep, aren't we?
Yep, yep. But, of course, the folks who want to get to the beach are the folks like you and me who just want to go and have a good time, and they've I have the right to be at the beach. And in California, the California Coastal Commission has mandated certain pathways. All of this access routes are created. So, you know, it's one thing. The other thing that's come out of this, of course, and here in America particularly, is the rise of the public beach, because most of us go to public beaches. You know, we can drive our car, park our car, and then, you know, get a place in the sand, put up our umbrella, get our blanket down, and then go in the water as we want to, or, you know, play the various games that are there too, listen to our private sound system, read our book from our iPad. You know, these are all, you know, quite wonderful things on public beaches. But, of course, the problem with the public beaches now is that if you park, it's very, you know, there's limited parking, and as more and more people want to park, that becomes an issue also. So that even public beaches are seeing a sort of rise in tension of access issues.
Yeah. Are you willing to fight that fight anymore? I mean, you said you were down there a couple of weeks ago. It's still worth it to you, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I lived in the town of Del Mar. I was teaching at the University of California, San Diego, and I lived in Del Mar for 22 years, sort of 400 yards away from the ocean. And it was great. You know, just the ability to walk down, walk along the beach, do whatever, or, you know, my wife and I like to body surf, so, you know, pick up your fins and walk down to the water and get in the water. Particularly July and August. Here in Southern California, the water's cold. But July and August, it perks up into the 70s, and it's bearable. And that was just, you know, it's a wonderful era of our lives. We quite enjoyed it.
Last question for you. When you were body surfing with those fins, or when you're down to the water these days, knowing what you know about the history of beaches, are you ever tempted to think, this salt water might be doing something good for my health?
No, I sort of, you know, looking for the next wave to see how I'm going to do. And I'm not thinking about, oh, this is good for me. It's good for me as long as I catch the wave right. It's bad for me if I miss the wave and, you know, go over the falls and smack myself on the sand. So that's what I'm thinking about, not this is good therapeutics. I'm a better person for this.
Robert Ritchie, a pleasure to visit with you. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Roy Ritchie is a senior research associate at the Huntington Library. He is author of The Lure of the Beach, A Global History. So once we've explained the allure of the beach and the evolution of beach culture, it's time to wade into the water and see if we can stand the cold and float, or better yet, swim. Humans love to swim. But why do we enjoy something so foreign to our usual element? Why we swim is the big question when Constant Wonder returns in just a moment. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Swimming has mental, emotional, physical, maybe even spiritual effects on us. For a lot of people, it's therapeutic and fun. Yet, unlike most other mammals, we have to learn how to swim. Why do humans swim anyway? And to find out, I had a chance to speak with Bonnie Choi. She's author of Why We Swim. We start here with a story about a real-life Icelandic legend, if I can say his name properly. His name was Gulagur Frithersson.
In 1984, he was a fisherman on a vessel, a trawler off the coast of Iceland, and he was 22, and it was one night in March. It was cold, 41-degree water, and the boat capsized. Everyone else on the boat drowned, but he swam 6 hours to safety. And once he got out of the water, he, you know, on the island where he's from. He had to walk across a lava field, and he finally got to help, and they took him to the hospital, and the doctors, you know, at first couldn't discern his heartbeat, and he was really thirsty, but he didn't show any signs of hypothermia. And, you know, in that temperature water, the rest of us anyway, would, you know, die of hypothermia within 20, 30 minutes. And he was fine. He was just a little bit dehydrated. And it turns out that he has a layer of fat that's 2 to 3 times normal human thickness. And so it was able to keep his core warm. And so he kept swimming, and he's a great swimmer. And, you know, the sort of Icelandic swimming tradition is that swimming education is mandatory. And he underwent all of these experiments and research and tests, and advocated for mandatory self-deploying life rafts, you know, in all of the fishing fleet in Iceland. And so that was his big cause, because, I mean, all of these things, you know, the interesting thing about his story is that it's a convergence of two things. One is just this Icelandic emphasis on swimming and swimming culture. I mean, every small town in Iceland has a pool, and it's partly because of the landscape where it's geothermally heated. And so the pools are outdoors year round, even in the wintertime, and everybody partakes, you know, young and old. It's just sort of, someone told me that the pool is our pub, you know, it's a cultural norm. And also to learn to swim is because it is as well because of the nature of this, the country is that it's surrounded by water, and it has a fishing tradition, and it's a story of drownings offshore everywhere. And so all of these things converge with his biological quirk to make him this mythic character in Iceland.
But you've met this mythic character face to face, I understand.
I have met this mythic character face to face, and I never thought I was going to. Even up until the day we met, and how it started was that I wrote him a letter, because over time, of course, many, many years of being asked by journalists, you know, the world over to tell his story, that gets exhausting and tiring. And it's certainly understandable if you think about it was a traumatic, it was the trauma of his life to lose his friends in this terrible accident. And he was the one who survived, and he was the one who was left to tell. You know, that can really be a hard burden to carry. And so,
oh, absolutely,
like anyone else, he wanted to just live his life, and he's lived a very good life since then, and wanted a quiet life. And, you know, I had some qualms about reaching out to him and tracking him down, because I didn't want to be someone who added to that trauma and to that burden. And so I wrote him a letter, and we became pen pals for a year before I finally met him. And he is a great friend of our families now.
Wow. And swimming still remains something he's willing to do?
You know, we talk about this, and I asked him, what is it, you know, what is it? I really wanted to know, is swimming something that, what do you think about it now? Does it feel like something that's enjoyable to you? And he thought about it, and he and his wife like to travel. And so they like to get in an RV and drive around, or they go to places like the Faroe Islands, or Faroe Islands is like the Icelanders' Iceland, the smaller and more rugged and, you know, distilled middle of the North Atlantic place. But I remember him saying that he was sitting somewhere in a pool that was overlooking the ocean, and he felt like it was this merging of those two places, you know. And so there is still this sense of joy and wonder in being in the water, and he had lots of stories to tell me.
That's heartening, actually, to think that in spite of the trepidation one might have, the genuine peril that water might present, mm-hmm. here he still is in a relationship with it where he's willing to see some kind of a beauty in it.
Yes, for sure.
Well, you spent some time going around the world to do a bit of a cultural comparison between different spots of the world where people may or may not have the same affinity for swimming that the Icelanders do. But it's not just one size fits all across this planet. Some people are swimmers or culturally inclined to swim, others not so much, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. One of the stories in the book that kind of illustrated this had to do with, strange as it may sound, Saddam Hussein's swimming pool. At the time, this was 2008, what was the Green Zone in Baghdad. Saddam Hussein's Republican Palace was part of the Green Zone. And so all of the, foreign U.S. Foreign Service workers and the military and all of the also international people who would come and do the work of trying to resolve the conflict there, they all were existing in this place that was called the Green Zone. And so in the Green Zone, diplomats and translators and, UN peacekeepers and all these troops would be staying here. And there was a pool because apparently Hussein and his sons were very fond of swimming. And so in all of their palaces, there were pools. And so there was this really opulent pool with fountains and diving boards. And this character I profile in the book, his name is Jay Taylor. He was a Foreign Service, lifetime Foreign Service, I guess a cultural attaché. He was a swimmer. He is a swimmer. And so he had taught swimming lessons and been a lifeguard. And he started to swim in this pool. And over time, people started asking him to teach them lessons. And so he started what ended up being called the Baghdad Swim Team. And to our initial question of, what is it that makes some people swim and others not? I mean, broadly across the world, it seems that no matter where you live, even if you live on an island where you think, oh, of course, everyone swims, it is really comes down to, do you have money, the time, and the access to water and swimming education?
There's going to be a class distinction here.
Absolutely. And so even in a place like Madagascar, which is an island, one of Jay Taylor's colleagues and friends and ended up being his assistant coach on this team was Andre Brembolo Manana. I don't know if I can, it's such a long name and I always have written it out and I realize now that I've never said it out loud. But Coach Andre was such a great character. He had this very traumatic experience as a kid where, he was thrown into the water and he said, never again, I'm never going to get in the water. But he's this athlete on land, kickboxer, just loves being active. And so when he got to Baghdad, he saw this pool and said, I'm going to learn how to swim. And so he would go religiously to the pool every day and just kind of thrash around and try to exhaust himself getting from one end to the next. And Jay saw him one day and said, Andre, what are you doing? And so he's, kind of took him on as a pupil, and then more students started coming. And it was this, I call it a mini United Nations of swimmers who got lessons from Coach Jay. And it's really this wonderful story of resilience and just escape and trying to find normalcy in a time of war.
I was very interested in the idea that access to water that you would swim in, access to pools in particular, that is possibly contingent upon your rank in society, the money you have, whether you're wealthy or not. And this brings to my mind Southern California, where I grew up, where there were pools in maybe every third or fourth backyard in my neighborhood. And there were some neighborhoods with no pools whatsoever, of course. And they're costly. But the history of this is fascinating, too, because we just kind of think it's a given that pools are often private when historically that's a pretty new thing.
Yeah, it is. And there is a very particular history of pools in this country. We talked a little bit before the break about swimming access globally, and that is certainly dependent on socioeconomic status. And here in America, it started out as something that was a public health, it was supposed to be a boon to public health to have all of these pools that were public baths that, at the turn of the 20th century, that working class people and immigrants were encouraged to use these public baths to to bathe in. You know, you would go in and you would swim around, and it was sort of like a cleanliness issue. At least it was perceived that way by municipal authorities who built these pools. And then over time, actually, I should mention that at the time that the hours were segregated by gender. So, you know, women would have one set of hours, and then the men would have another set of hours. And so that the restrictions were based upon, you know, the sexes mixing. And then as swimming and pools became more of a luxury, a sort of a recreation where families were encouraged to go do this, then it became that, you know, bigger and more opulent public works pools were built around the country. Again, the public health and the public messaging shifted to, you know, recreation and learning how to swim and teaching kids how to swim and just being together as families and spending time. It was like a leisure thing. And then as that happened, then the issue of race came in. And so it was that people started then restricting access for Blacks and other races from mixing with whites. And so it was then a race issue that was segregating the pools and restricting access. And
I can see where this is leading, because it's kind of like a parallel to white flight from neighborhoods.
Exactly. And that's exactly what happened to the pools. The public pools then losing funding, as people with means, and that was essentially white people, started building private pools in their backyards, and then the community pools fell into disrepair, and then the access diminished. And so this, you can see then how this history of racism in this country leads to a gap in swimming education, a racial gap that still has not been closed. And it's a legacy that is just really needs to be addressed, in my opinion, a larger, more universal scale.
Boy, we could go into this topic and spend another hour on it, because when I was a kid growing up in Southern California, little did I know that when I was in a neighbor's backyard pool, that pool represented, or I might have seen it as, a legacy of racism in America.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of twist upends your understanding of what I think a lot of us take for granted, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the general universal question, why we swim, given the fact, as we mentioned a while back, we're not naturals at it. We don't come by this just because of our evolution, apparently. Of all mammals, we seem particularly inept. Do we have any understanding of why humans ventured into the water and said, well, let's have swimming lessons now?
You know, the funny thing about swimming is that it leaves a wake that disappears, right? So the evidence is you have to kind of come at it from an oblique angle. And it was interesting to do that, to ask a range of scientists and scholars and researchers about what, you know, to help me put together this picture of what early human swimming might have looked like.
And I immediately would just say that necessity is the mother of invention. I would perceive that there had to be some reason, a need.
Yeah. And so the first section of the book is survival, because obviously we swim first and foremost to survive the water. We started to do it because it helped us in some way to survive better, you know, whether it was to access more food resources, you know, in water, fishing, diving for shellfish, you know, all that. And to also to venture to new lands where that would benefit our, our families, our larger communities for early humans. And so there is really interesting evidence in the Sahara of when the Sahara was green, that there are these paleolakes that peoples lived along the edges of for thousands of years. And there is a particular settlement that's called Gobro, and the lake system is called Paleolake Gobro. And this pretty famous paleontologist, Paul Sereno, discovered it on an expedition. It goes back in 2000, and he has been studying it ever since and uncovering all this evidence of peoples living there and thriving there because of this stable system of water. And so there's this one particular burial that he unearthed that was like the triple burial. And it was so poignant because it was a mother and two young children. And the speculation is that they drowned, you know, and then were sort of ceremonially buried together. And you can kind of think, you can picture it. And in the book, I try to reconstruct this after interviewing Paul Sereno. And it's not so far off from a lot of the things that we can imagine today, where you're watching your kids kind of get closer and closer to the water, and you maybe get distracted, and maybe the one kid goes under and the other kid goes after, and then you go after, and then everyone drowns. I mean, it's a story that is like as old as time. And in this particular settlement, you know, they had big middens of shellfish. They had fishing equipment, they had spears, they had all kinds of things that suggested that they lived a life that was very stable and thrived by the water.
Very much signs of aquatic activity, of humans going in. You got to get the shellfish by going in.
Yeah, exactly. They don't come to you.
Yeah. So in ancient cultures, we were finding evidence that humans were swimming for food. The recreational aspect is such an interesting one. And nowadays we swim, and this is maybe jumping a few chapters in your book, but we swim for our health. We swim mm-hmm. to be fit. And mm-hmm. I would love to have you conclude by telling us a little bit about hot and cold water. There's fascinating physiological responses to hot and cold water.
Yes. Well, so water is just beneficial to us. There is actually quite a lot of research and studies that show that have studied how our bodies respond, our human bodies specifically respond to water, and then of different temperatures and how it's promotes circulation and relaxation, and also in patients with arthritis, that swimming in cool water helps with mobility and reduction in pain, and that those benefits, you know, just like the motion, the being able to exercise without pain, that those benefits last beyond the time that you leave the water. So then, you know, people who suffer from arthritis, that they leave the pool and just in their normal everyday activities, they are feeling better and they have better mobility and they just have a better lives and feel healthier because they swim. And so there's a lot of evidence that points towards that, but also just how our bodies respond to cold water is just the stimulus of, increased circulation. And even though you kind of get close to, you know, early signs of hypothermia, that people dance near the edge, and you see this with cold water, open water swimmers, because it brings them back feeling more alive. And there is actually a benefit to that. And there's sort of new research into ice water and what cold water immersion does to us. That is really interesting. And it's sort of like you think about jumping into cold water on New Year's Day. I mean, there's something, the polar bear experience that we've known culturally and traditionally is just like, it feels good. It feels like renewal. It feels like rebirth. And in some ways it really is.
But it's more than just a symbolic gesture of meeting the new year and a rebirth. You talk about the metabolic rate increasing 350%
cold water,
exactly. Dopamine going up. And I've thought about how many times have I been swimming when I'm done with my swim in cold water, I'm just famished, I'm hungry, and I think, well, maybe that's that metabolic rate now.
Right.
There's a reason for it.
All of the science is starting to catch up to all of these things that we have done for many centuries and millennia around the water. You know, I think back to the Greeks and the Romans and the Chinese and the Japanese, like all these sort of Zen practices, the cleansing practices, the water cures, dipping in cold seawater, that was a cure for everything. And there's so much history and writing, medical writing about all of this stuff that is just, you look back and you think, oh, that is hooey. But here, now, in this day, we have the science that is catching up to explain to us why what we knew instinctively to be true really is helpful to us.
Bonnie Choi is author of Why We Swim. Now, once you get comfortable in the water, and you've lost your inordinate fear of drowning, if you're doing it right, that is, maybe it's time to take it to the next level. How about swimming with sharks, skipping dolphins? Here is a highlight of a conversation I had with Christina Zanotto, an ocean explorer, a shark professional, occasionally a shark dentist. She explains here why she helps them and why she feels for them when they suffer.
These are my sharks. I've been working with them for 25 years. And although not the sharks that were there 25 years are not here anymore, I've known sharks, some of them, for the last 12 to 13 years, like Stompy, Grandma, for example, Crook, have been there between 10 and 13 years. And to me, when I see them with the hooks and their jaws swollen, or when they have difficulty eating, it's like seeing my dog coming out of the bush with a thorn in the paw going, ooh, I can't walk anymore. And so it's the same instinct. It's like, I can't save all the sharks in the world, and I understand that, but I definitely want to improve the quality of life of the sharks that I work with. And all those the things that people say, oh, well, the hook is going to rust, or it's a myth, the shark can absorb the hook. I think they should come and dive with these sharks and watch them when for several weeks in a row they can't feed because their jaw is swollen or because it hurts just to move it or because the lure is coming through their gills and basically scraping their entire side raw. So it is a mercy, but it's the same mercy that we would extend to any animal that we're familiar with. And through that, I hope to kind of like show an example. I've received a lot of messages going, oh, I never thought a shark could suffer, or I never thought about sharks in that way. And hopefully what I do with this shark may inspire other people, hopefully not to go out and try to remove hooks. I don't recommend that unless you have knowledge. But to look at sharks as creatures, as beings that have feelings and fears. And their basic desires is basically to continue to survive. They survived 5 massive extinctions. Hopefully they'll survive this one. And all they want to do is basically roam the oceans. They really have nothing to do with us. And they're not monsters. They're not killing machines. They're just fish, animals, creatures.
Christina Zanotto, an ocean explorer and a shark professional, probably best not to try this at your own local beach. Water is a foreign element to us, but swimming can be immensely fun. Probably no surprise, though, to think that outer space could be similarly exhilarating. You can swim around out there, maybe. Or what's it really like? Well, tomorrow we're going to speak with an astronaut who has a unique perspective on what it's like spending any real time up in space. How to Astronaut. Tomorrow on our show, I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.